Hello and welcome to The Village Green, a New England music sampler with DJ Frederick. Featuring a freeform mix of tunes by New England musicians past and present, weaving a mosaic that enlivens our ears and lives. Homegrown music from your neighbors and friends, from the Canadian border to the New York state line. Much of today's hour-long program is going to be taken up with one piece by the late Robert J. Lertzema. Great disc jockey, radio announcer, who worked with WGBH, National Public Radio, and who was the voice of Morning Pro Musica for many, many years. We're going to hear him with the Paul Winter Consort, telling a story by Gene Giono, called The Man Who Planted Trees. This was originally released in 1985.
The Man Who Planted Trees. For a human character to reveal truly exceptional qualities, one must have the good fortune to be able to observe its performance over many years. If this performance is devoid of all egoism, if its guiding motive is unparalleled generosity, if it is absolutely certain that there is no thought of recompense, and that, in addition, it has left its visible mark upon the earth, then there can be no mistake. About 40 years ago, I was taking a long trip on foot over mountain heights quite unknown to tourists in that ancient region where the Alps thrust down into Provence. All this, at the time I embarked upon my long walk through these deserted regions, was barren and colorless land. Nothing grew there but wild lavender. I was crossing the area at its widest point, and after 3 days walking, found myself in the midst of unparalleled desolation. I camped near the vestiges of an abandoned village. I'd run out of water the day before and had to find some. These clustered houses, although in ruins like an old wasp's nest, suggested that there must once have been a spring or well here. There was indeed a spring, but it was dry. The five or six houses, roofless, gnawed by the wind and rain, the tiny chapel with its crumbling steeple, stood about like houses and chapels in living villages, but all life had vanished. It was a fine June day, brilliant with sunlight, but over this unsheltered land, high in the sky, the wind blew with unendurable ferocity. It growled over the carcasses of the houses like a lion disturbed at its meal. I had to move my camp. After 5 hours walking, I had still not found water, and there was nothing to give me any hope of finding any. All about me was the same dryness, the same coarse grasses. I thought I glimpsed in the distance a small black silhouette, upright, and took it for the trunk of a solitary tree. In any case, I started toward it. It was a shepherd. 30 sheep were lying about him on the baking earth. He gave me a drink from his water gourd, and a little later took me to his cottage in a fold of the plain. He drew his water, excellent water, from a very deep natural well above which he had constructed a primitive winch. The man spoke little. This is the way of those who live alone. But one felt that he was sure of himself and confident in his assurance. That was unexpected in this barren country. He lived not in a cabin, but in a real house built of stone that bore plain evidence of how his own efforts had reclaimed the ruin he had found there on his arrival. His roof was strong and sound. The wind on its tiles made the sound of the sea upon its shore. The place was in order. The dishes washed, the floor swept, his rifle oiled. His soup was boiling over the fire. I noticed then that he was cleanly shaved, that all his buttons were firmly sewed on, that his clothing had been mended with a meticulous care that makes the mending invisible. He shared his soup with me, and afterwards, when I offered my tobacco pouch, he told me that he did not smoke. His dog, as silent as himself, was friendly without being servile. It was understood from the first that I should spend the night there. The nearest village was still more than a day and a half away. Besides, I was perfectly familiar with the nature of the rare villages in that region. There were 4 or 5 of them scattered well apart from each other on these mountain slopes, among white oak thickets at the extreme end of the wagon roads. They were inhabited by charcoal burners, and the living was bad. Families crowded together in a climate that is excessively harsh both in winter and in summer found no escape from the unceasing conflict of personalities. Irrational ambition reached inordinate proportions in the continued desire for escape. The men took their wagon loads of charcoal to the town, then returned. The soundest characters broke under the perpetual grind. The women nursed their grievances. There was rivalry in everything, over the price of charcoal as over a pew in the church, over warring virtues as over warring vices, as well as over the ceaseless combat between virtue and vice. And over all, there was the wind, also ceaseless, to rasp upon the nerves. There were epidemics of suicide and frequent cases of insanity, usually homicidal. The shepherd went to fetch a small sack and poured out a heap of acorns on the table. He began to inspect them, one by one, with great concentration, separating the good from the bad. I smoked my pipe. I did offer to help him. He told me that it was his job. And in fact, seeing the care he devoted to the task, I did not insist. That was the whole of our conversation. When he had set aside a large enough pile of good acorns, he counted them out by tens, meanwhile eliminating the small ones or those which were slightly cracked, for now he examined them more closely. When he had thus selected 100 perfect acorns, he stopped, and we went to bed. There was peace in being with this man. The next day, I asked if I might rest here for a day. He found it quite natural, or to be more exact, he gave me the impression that nothing could startle him. The rest was not absolutely necessary, but I was interested and wished to know more about him. He opened the pen and led his flock to pasture. Before leaving, he plunged his sack of carefully selected and counted acorns into a pail of water. I noticed that he carried for a stick an iron rod as thick as my thumb and about a yard and a half long. Resting myself by walking, I followed a path parallel to his. His pasture was in a valley. He left the dog in charge of the little flock and climbed toward where I stood. I was afraid that he was about to rebuke me for my indiscretion, but it was not that at all. This was the way he was going, and he invited me to go along if I had nothing better to do. He climbed to the top of the ridge, about 100 yards away. There he began thrusting his iron rod into the earth, making a hole in which he planted an acorn. Then he refilled the hole. He was planting oak trees. I asked him if the land belonged to him. He answered, no. Did he know whose it was? He did not. He supposed it was community property or perhaps belonged to people who cared nothing about it. He was not interested in finding out whose it was. He planted his 100 acorns with the greatest care. After the midday meal, he resumed his planting. I suppose I must have been fairly insistent in my questioning, for he answered me. For 3 years, he had been planting trees in this wilderness. He had planted 100,000. Of the 100,000, 20,000 had sprouted. Of the 20,000, he still expected to lose about half to rodents or to the unpredictable designs of Providence. There remained 10,000 oak trees to grow where nothing had grown before. That was when I began to wonder about the age of this man. He was obviously over 50. 55, he told me. His name was Elzéar Bouffier. He had once had a farm in the lowlands. There he had had his life. He had lost his only son, then his wife. He had withdrawn into this solitude, where his pleasure was to live leisurely with his lambs and his dog. It was his opinion that this land was dying for want of trees. He added that, having no very pressing business of his own, he had resolved to remedy the state of affairs. Since I was at that time, in spite of my youth, leading a solitary life, I understood how to deal gently with solitary spirits. But my very youth forced me to consider the future in relation to myself and to a certain quest for happiness. I told him that in 30 years, his 10,000 oaks would be magnificent. He answered quite simply that if God granted him life, in 30 years, he would have planted so many more that these 10,000 would be like a drop of water in the ocean. Besides, he was now studying the reproduction of beech trees and had a nursery of seedlings grown from beech nuts near his cottage. The seedlings, which he had protected from his sheep with a wire fence, were very beautiful. He was also considering birches for the valleys where, he told me, there was a certain amount of moisture a few yards below the surface of the soil. The next day, we parted. The following year came the War of 1914, in which I was involved for the next 5 years. An infantryman hardly had time for reflecting upon trees. To tell the truth, the thing itself had made no impression upon me. I'd considered it as a hobby, a stamp collection, and forgotten it. The war over, I found myself possessed of a tiny demobilization bonus and a huge desire to breathe fresh air for a while. It was with no other objective that I again took the road to the barren lands. The countryside had not changed. However, beyond the deserted village, I glimpsed in the distance a sort of grayish mist that covered the mountaintops like a carpet. Since the day before, I had begun to think again of the shepherd tree planter. 10,000 oaks, I reflected, really take up quite a bit of space. I had seen too many men die during those 5 years not to imagine easily that Elzéar Bouffier was dead, especially since at 20, one regards men of 50 as old men with nothing left to do but die. He was not dead. As a matter of fact, he was extremely spry. He had changed jobs. Now he had only 4 sheep, but instead, 100 beehives. He had got rid of the sheep because they threatened his young trees. For he told me, and I saw for myself, the war had disturbed him not at all. He had imperturbably continued to plant. The oaks of 1910 were then 10 years old and taller than either of us. It was an impressive spectacle. I was literally speechless, and as he did not talk, we spent the whole day walking in silence through the forest. In 3 sections, it measured 11 kilometers in length and 3 kilometers at its greatest width. When you remembered that all this had sprung from the hands and the soul of this one man, without technical resources, You understood that men could be as effectual as God in other realms than that of destruction. He had pursued his plan, and beech trees as high as my shoulder, spreading out as far as the eye could reach, confirmed it. He showed me handsome clumps of birch planted 5 years before, that is in 1915, when I had been fighting at Verdun. He had set them out in all the valleys where he had guessed, and rightly, that there was moisture almost at the surface of the ground. They were as delicate as young girls and very well established. Creation seemed to come about in a sort of chain reaction. He did not worry about it. He was determinedly pursuing his task in all its simplicity. But as we went back toward the village, I saw water flowing in brooks that had been dry since the memory of man. This was the most impressive result of chain reaction that I had seen. These dry streams had once long ago run with water. Some of the dreary villages I mentioned before had been built on the sites of ancient Roman settlements, traces of which still remained, and archaeologists, exploring there, had found fish hooks, where in the 20th century, cisterns were needed to assure a small supply of water. The wind, too, scattered seeds. As the water reappeared, so there reappeared willows, rushes, meadows, gardens, flowers, and a certain purpose in being alive. But the transformation took place so gradually that it became part of the pattern without causing any astonishment. Hunters climbing into the wilderness in pursuit of hares or wild boar had of course noticed the sudden growth of little trees, but had attributed it to some natural caprice of the earth. That is why no one meddled with Elzéar Bouffier's work. If he had been detected, he would have had opposition. He was indetectable. Who in the villages or in the administration could have dreamed of such perseverance in a magnificent generosity? To have anything like a precise idea of this exceptional character, one must not forget that he worked in total solitude, so total that toward the end of his life, he lost the habit of speech, or perhaps it was that he saw no need for it. In 1933, he received a visit from a forest ranger who notified him of an order against lighting fires out of doors for fear of endangering the growth of this natural forest. It was the first time, the man told him naively, that he had ever heard of a forest growing of its own accord. At that time, Bouffier was about to plant beeches at a spot some 12 kilometers from his cottage. In order to avoid traveling back and forth, for he was then 75, he planned to build a stone cabin right at the plantation. The next year, he did so. In 1935, a whole delegation came from the government to examine the natural forest. There was a high official from the Forest Service, a deputy, technicians. There was a great deal of ineffectual talk. It was decided that something must be done. Unfortunately, nothing was done, except the only helpful thing. The whole forest was placed under the protection of the state, and charcoal burning prohibited, for it was impossible not to be captivated by the beauty of those young trees and the fullness of health, and they cast their spell over the deputy himself. friend of mine was among the forestry officers of the delegation. To him, I explained the mystery. One day the following week, we went together to see Elzéar Bouffier. We found him hard at work, some 10 kilometers from the spot where the inspection had taken place. This forester was not my friend for nothing. He was aware of values. He knew how to keep silent. I delivered the eggs I had brought as a present. We shared a lunch among the three of us and spent several hours in wordless contemplation of the countryside. In the direction from which we had come, the slopes were covered with trees, 20 to 25 feet tall. I remembered how the land had looked in 1913, a desert. Peaceful, regular toil, the vigorous mountain air, frugality, and above all, serenity of spirit had endowed this old man with awe-inspiring health. He was one of God's athletes. I wondered how many more acres he was going to cover with trees. Before leaving, my friend simply made a brief suggestion about certain species of trees that the soil here seemed particularly suited for. He did not force the point, for the very good reason, he told me later, that Bouffier knows more about it than I do. At the end of an hour's walking, having turned it over in his mind, he added, "He knows a lot more about it than anybody. He's discovered a wonderful way to be happy." It was thanks to this officer that not only the forest, but also the happiness of the man was protected. He delegated 3 rangers to the task and so terrorized them that they remained proof against all the bottles of wine the charcoal burners could offer. The only serious danger to the work occurred during the war of 1939. As cars were being run on gasogenes, wood-burning generators, there was never enough wood. Cutting was started among the oaks of 1910, but the area was so far from any railroad that the enterprise turned out to be financially unsound. It was abandoned. The shepherd had seen nothing of it. He was 30 kilometers away, peacefully continuing his work, ignoring the War of 39 as he had ignored that of 14. I saw Elzé Arbufier for the last time in June of 1945. He was then 87. I had started back along the route through the wastelands, but now, in spite of the disorder in which the war had left the country, there was a bus running between the Durance Valley and the mountain. I attributed the fact that I no longer recognized the scenes of my earlier journeys to this relatively speedy transportation. It seemed to me, too, that the route took me through new territory. It took the name of a village to convince me that I was actually in that region that had been all ruins and desolation. The bus put me down at Vergon. In 1913, this hamlet of 10 or 12 houses had 3 inhabitants. They had been savage creatures, hating one another, living by trapping game, little removed, both physically and morally, from the conditions of prehistoric man. All about them, nettles were feeding upon the remains of abandoned houses. Their condition had been beyond hope. For them, nothing but to await death, a situation which rarely predisposes to virtue. Everything was changed, even the air. Instead of the harsh, dry winds that used to attack me, a gentle breeze was blowing, laden with scents. A sound like water came from the mountains. It was the wind in the forest. Most amazing of all, I heard the actual sound of water falling into a pool. I saw that a fountain had been built, that it flowed freely, and what touched me most, that someone had planted a linden beside it. A linden that must have been 4 years old, already in full leaf, the incontestable symbol of resurrection. Besides, Vergon bore evidence of labor and the sort of undertaking for which hope is required. Hope, then, had returned. Ruins had been cleared away, dilapidated walls torn down, and 5 houses restored. Now there were 28 inhabitants, 4 of them young married couples. The new houses, freshly plastered, were surrounded by gardens where vegetables and flowers grew in orderly confusion, cabbages and roses, leeks and snapdragons, celery and anemones. It was now a village where one would like to live. From that point on, I went on foot. The war just finished had not yet allowed the full blooming of life, but Lazarus was out of the tomb. On the lower slopes of the mountain, I saw little fields of barley and of rye. Deep in the narrow valleys, the meadows were turning green. It has taken only the 8 years since then for the whole countryside to glow with health and prosperity. On the site of ruins I had seen in 1913, now stand neat farms, cleanly plastered, testifying to a happy and comfortable life. The old streams, fed by the rains and snows that the forest conserves, are flowing again. Their waters have been channeled. On each farm, in groves of maples, fountain pools overflow onto carpets of fresh mint. Little by little, the villages have been rebuilt. People from the plains, where land is costly, have settled here, bringing youth, motion, the spirit of adventure. Along the roads, you meet hardy men and women, boys and girls who understand laughter and have recovered a taste for picnics. Counting the former population, unrecognizable now that they live in comfort, more than 10,000 people owe their happiness to Elzé Arbufier. When I reflect that one man, armed only with his own physical and moral resources, was able to cause this land of Canaan to spring from the wasteland, I am convinced that in spite of everything, humanity is admirable. But when I compute the unfailing greatness of spirit and the tenacity of benevolence that it must have taken to achieve this result, I am taken with an immense respect for that old and unlearned peasant who was able to complete a work worthy of God. Elzéar Bouffier died peacefully in 1947 at the hospice in Bannon.
You've been listening to The Man Who Planted Trees, a story by Jean Giono, with music by the Paul Winter Consort, and narrated by Robert J. Lertzema, That was released in 1985, recorded in Connecticut, with Paul Winter on soprano sax, Paul Helly on piano, Eugene Friesen on cello, Mark Perchinock on heckelphone, Glenn Velez with percussion, and the bass was played by Russ Landau. Well, this is the Village Green, a New England music sampler. I do hope that you've been enjoying the programs. This is program number 26. If you'd like more information, you can contact me at singinggrove@conknet.com. That's singinggrove@conknet.com. Or check out the blog at newenglandmusic.blogspot.com. We're going to shift into something a little bit different right now with Adrian Otterman, also known as Over Orange Heights, from his CD Floating in the Whale. This is Green Mountain Skies.
Love the train leaves here tonight. Do you dare to come along? I can't promise you a comfy bed of roses, but we'll find our own damn thorns. I know you hate to leave your family and the only town you know. I also know that life is somewhere out there waiting, if you've got the will to go. She told me that she loved me once upon a time. Stories, what's the moral behind mine? There's nothing left of history on the dark green mountain skies. So I'm heading down to Tennessee, gonna kiss this town goodbye tonight. That Corey, my father cut that stone. Now the damn folks say it's all just too destructive, so smug as if they know. There's nothing left of history under dark green mountain sky. This town goodbye tonight. Still, I tried to keep that paycheck. Then the granite jobs went east. Well, they say the state is great for raising children. Tonight. There's no
shotgun down the avalanche. Oh, tumbling and falling down the avalanche. Oh, so be quiet tonight. Stars shine bright on this mountain of new. So much, and it's so bizarre. A mystery goes on and on and on. Well, this is the best thing and the very most hard, 'cause we don't get along. And after countless appeals, we keep spinning our wheels on this mountain of new fallen snow. For your soul. Oh, but the past is stronger than my will to forgive you or myself. I don't know. And I'm riding shotgun down the avalanche. Oh, tumbling and falling.
I come visit you this summer way upon that farm in New Hampshire. I won't stay long, I'll stay out of your way. Just wanna see your smile on a green summer day. And is there a river where we can go swimming, take off our clothes, have a new beginning, watch the dirt fall from our fingers and toes, lay out on the flat river stones in the sun's beams through the flowering trees, kiss you so sweet. I go back to your arms again, where my heart has always been. Can I crawl into the cracks of your smile, run my hand down your back while, where the eyes are the ones I know, where I laid so long ago, where the arms are the ones I've seen. Mountains white, mountains green, and the sun. Oh, Yes, my love, you can come and see me. Though again, I know you'll leave me. Our hearts can only bend so long. There's a reason why. You've been gone to the rivers, mountains and the hills, the late night parties, daffodils, the inside passage, the Mackinac, where you became part of all that you saw, the songs made, the flowering trees, kisses so sweet.
Robert Saracen Blake, a great song called Farmhouse in New Hampshire. Before that, we heard Salamander Crossing with their version of Shotgun Down the Avalanche. And we started this set off with Adrian Otterman, who records under the name of Over Orange Heights. A tune called Green Mountain Skies from the CD Floating in the Whale. For more information, you can check out www.OverOrangeHeights.com. Well, this is DJ Frederick, and you've been listening to program number 26 of the Village Green, a New England music sampler. I'd like to say hello to everybody listening on Troubadour 1700, my absolute favorite internet radio station, who hopefully is going to be back on the airwaves soon on AM. Low power to the people. Reminding you, take care of your friends, take care of your family, make sure that your community gets what it needs to thrive. Think global and listen local. The Village Green, a New England music sampler, is a seldom heard radio production.